And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
I'm Tori Clark, and this is Chatter on Books. Richard Armstrong is our guest author tonight with a really, really fun book called The Don Con, which I have to say, as I was reading it, I was going, wait a minute, is this part real? Is this part...
I know,
because it could be very real.
Is this about organized crime?
Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Do I know that person? Why do I know that person? I should know that person. And that's David Aldridge, and Michael Kornheiser's here, and G. McManus is here, and Claude is here running the board, whatever that is. And it's our 44th episode. Here from the undisclosed location. Doing great. So we got a few things tonight. We got some randoms. We've got tonight's debate on blurbs. Richard, you can get in on that one too.
Yeah.
Blurbs. Love them, hate them. Does anybody care? Then we're going to talk to Richard about his very interesting background, because most of our authors wanted to be astronauts or they were lawyers. And you actually come from a field that might actually apply to writing, which might be our first ever. And then Deserted Island, we're going to do better than the bestseller list. So randoms, happy birthday today, Margaret Atwood, November 18th, and, oh, I got to do cheese and wine too, don't let me forget that. Margaret Atwood, born in 1939. So I thought I knew a lot about Margaret Atwood, and Michael, this one is probably right up your alley as well. Do you realize this technology tool development that she came up with called LongPen?
No.
On top of
no, every, but I'm interested.
Yeah, on top of everything else, she wanted to come up with a device by which you could do essentially real-time editing, online editing, those kinds of things. And she, I think it seems like a pretty successful thing. She makes a fair amount of money off it. But right. She's not just the author of all time.
But is it like software that she invented?
Yeah. She came
but
up with
surely
it.
Surely there are
patents
thing,
and things
there
like that.
Things like that.
It sounds very similar to some other things that are available, but she came up with this
used
a while ago.
Okay. Right.
And I'm not going to call it. She's certainly not a hermit, but she had an interesting childhood, a little homeschooling. A lot of our authors are also homeschooled, if anybody else has noticed that. A little bit of homeschooling, but realized at a young age she really liked writing and got into poetry and things like that. But then I think she got a little frustrated by the process of sending off manuscripts and getting them back and who did what. And so she started coming up with these technologies.
Wow. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. What was the actress that came up with something during World War II? Was some sort of encryption spy thing.
Yes.
I want to say
an actress.
Yes, a very
it had
famous
something to do with the radar. Actually,
yeah. Was it? Yeah, was it Ava Gardner? It was somebody very famous.
Yes,
really.
She was very smart. Apparently, yes. I can't. Yeah. I'm
wasn't right. Julia Child?
It was not Julia Child. I've cut the dickens out of my finger. No.
I know some real aging spooks who were real spooks in the age of Julia Child, and they hate her. Because you never talk about and brag about what you did. And in her later in her cooking career, she talked about and bragged about what she did. The Testaments has dropped off your bestseller list, by the way, Ms. McManus. You noticed?
Yes. Well, as we've discussed on this show, I believe none of us has ever read a Margaret Atwood novel, if I'm not mistaken.
Richard, have you read any?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing.
Zero.
This is one
out of this conversation.
No, Michael, you read Handmaid's Tale. You had to, right?
No.
I think I told you that I had Handmaid's Tale when it first came out. I got it. This is how long ago it was. I got it from the Book of the Month Club.
Nice.
Where it sat on a shelf.
Nice.
My, you know,
I
decades.
Think this is like, I used to work for the cable TV industry, and we used to always laugh, and you do all this research, and you ask people, what do you watch on television? 99% of the people answer, PBS.
Local news.
Wow. Well, you know, World Wrestling seems to be doing really well. I don't know who
they
those
are. They all replay
Boyfriend
Girls.
I think people lie about things like that.
Oh, well, my friend Rita Kempley, who was a movie critic at the Washington Post, she and her husband, Ed, were chosen by Nielsen for Nielsen ratings.
A little notebook.
So they would turn on the TV when they were going out to a movie or dinner or something, they would turn on the TV to something very noble, like PBS. And she wrote
great.
About it, and they slammed her for doing that.
For admitting that she had done that?
Yeah, for her false input. But
we went to see Ford versus Ferrari last night.
How was it?
I liked it.
Okay.
It's very, and I'm a sucker for anything that's just beautifully filmed. I still feel the worst thing I ever did was read Anne Hornaday's book. Talking, yeah. I can't remember the name of it, but Anne Hornaday is remarkable and really smart. And I got about halfway through a book, and I thought, I had no idea these things were going on in movies. I'm just sitting there going, yeah, pretty pictures, like good-looking guy.
The production stuff was so interesting.
Yeah, but this movie is beautifully filmed. I liked it. I liked that. It's kind of a buddy movie. Yeah. It had lots of, Brian, the bartender, got it correct. He said it's kind of like, you know, kind of a Chinese menu or an a la carte menu. There's a little something for everybody. If you liked Fast Cars and Crashes, mm-hmm, it had that. If you wanted a buddy movie, you had that. It was good. Liked it a lot.
Yeah.
Lee Iacocca comes across as, you know, okay. All right, Michael, are you ready for our email? Okay, this isn't book club therapy, but this
I don't get to read the email this time.
No, because Mary, who sent it to me, suggested strongly at the top that I should edit at will, which I will, because it involves a lot of that word that rhymes with rump that can get people really excited. So she has a lot of that, which I won't won't read. There, Rush Limbaugh is in there. I thought, nope, that's not good. We're not going to go with that.
How are you connecting me with this email?
I'll get to that because she names you. She names you. So, very long story short, Mary and friends, I'm not sure what part of the world we're in, but she does give the percentage of people who voted for Trump. Angela Davis is coming to speak in their community, and some people are upset about it. And so what Mary and friends are doing is they are sponsoring sessions to talk about Angela Davis and talk and read her book and talk about what she has to say about things in life and what she did in her past, because they thought that would make people understand and appreciate things more. And then they're going to have another session after Angela comes. Then there's some people who are offering to pay Angela not to appear in their community, but we won't go into all of that. But, her question is, how do you deal with controversial books? How do you get people to read books that make them feel uncomfortable? How do you get through your own discomfort with subject matter? Personally, I would rather read about difficult subjects than see them depicted on screen, but that's just me. It allows me to take a break and gather my thoughts and then begin again. I think Mary's very smart. Maybe Michael dealt with this when he was teaching high school. I know I did when I taught high school. I would like to hear his thoughts. So difficult books, how do you get people to read them, understand them, maybe appreciate them without losing their minds?
I think the first thing is always to identify and explicitly name what it is that you're bringing to the table. So if it's a book that might be dealing with sort of your own shortcoming or what you might not be able to see or know because of your own experiences, who you are, your upbringing, your education, any of those factors, I think it's important to put that on the table. This unfortunately becomes a lot easier when the sort of difference or the controversial topic is outside of the self. It's easier for us to identify it and to put it up on the table and have us all bring our own lenses or, you know, magnifying glasses to examine that. It's obviously a lot harder when you are bringing something close to home. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with kids, I actually find a lot of times when you're bringing the personal in and you are more responsive and more honest in your sort of gut reaction, it's the most powerful. I'm thinking about various elections where I've been in the classroom and people have done, you know, head counts. We're going to put up at the front of the board who you're voting for. And it can be, on one hand, really powerful for a kid to see an ally or someone who thinks like them at the front of the class. But you also have a lot of other class days and class periods where that's not necessarily the most comfortable space for these kids. But I think the first piece always comes down to owning your, I would say owning, the phrase we sometimes use is the skin that I'm in, here's what I'm bringing to the table.
So that's what Mary should tell her friends when they all get together in town. It looks like middle America.
I think it starts there, but I mean, you have so many different question, like if you're going to be breaking out into different focus groups or thought groups here, how are we going to be dividing the lines? Because something as simple as is one group meeting after work versus on the weekend, that all those little differences could influence the way that they're going to enter into this conversation. Are they ready to have this talk, or are they doing it begrudgingly? Are they doing it just to show face in the community?
So would a high school in the DMV ever pick a book like Angela Davis's book?
Depends on the high school.
Yeah,
I mean, I hate to give that false answer. It depends. You know, so many of these high schools, are we talking about a parochial school? Are we talking about a community public school? Are we talking about an independent school? I mean, so many of these.
Moray, home of the Frogs.
Okay, Moray is a, okay, as I'm entering this conversation, Moray is a school where not only do I still work in some capacity as a golf coach, but it's a school where I was a teacher and.
Okay, I used to be on the board of Potomac. They would never pick a book like this. They picked all the classic books there on, you know, Handmaid's Tale, right?
But you could probably find a book in their reading list that is say, similar in tone, but on the other side, or is it?
Would they have Invisible Man or Native Son?
Yes.
I mean, it's not quite Angela Davis, right. I realize, yeah. but still something that might kind of shake things up a little bit.
And I think the tough thing is what happens when you have a super interested teacher who wants to bring a specific author who just happens to be, I mean, even when you're trying to deal with this show, sometimes you're wondering, who can I get, or what are we dealing with on campus right now versus the canon where we've had the same teacher who's been there for 30 years, who's been the head of the department and has a very clear vision as to what the reading list at the Potomac School should look like.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have big swings and misses. I've taught books that have that were topical for what, I mean, one of the books we mentioned early on in the show, The Virgin Suicides. I had a classroom where I had to gut the book in the 11th hour because we were dealing with a school tragedy. And that was, you know, again, it actually turned into a good rebound moment because our class ended up doing independent projects. But there's a lot of factors that go into making those lists difficult to try and address. But it's, again, even if there you understand where, if I'm coming from Potomac and I recognize I came from a very traditional, structured background, how does that affect the books that I'm going to read? What am I missing when I'm thinking about those very traditional choices?
Yeah. Potomac, it's all dystopian. It's all it's just remarkable.
If that's what the kids are reading, that's a good starting point.
Okay. This could go on forever. Because what I said when I was there is, okay, that may be what they're interested in and that's their niche, but shouldn't we be trying to broaden their horizons? Shouldn't we be trying to expose them to some things they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to? Nope. We're going to do dystopian. Grab. Hated it. Okay. Now, the best part, Mary, thank you, Mary, for sending the email. She says, thank you. And even when I get behind listening, I love the show and hearing the voices of the authors you have on. Thank you. So thank you, Mary. Very,
very nice.
Okay. So wait, I was over at Calvert Woodley today. I forgot cheese and wine. Went to see Michael, who's doing great. It's a very busy time of the year. No surprise. And
to stop by for some Thanksgiving pairings.
Yes, you need to stop by for some Thanksgiving pairings. And I ordered a case. I got a little caught up. They have the commemorative bottles of wine for the Washington Nationals. So I don't know if you've seen the pictures of these, but they are absolutely, the bottles are beautiful. It's a red wine. They swear to me that it's pretty good. Not that I care. But it's a beautiful bottle, and it's hard
like
to describe.
It's like a locker room wine that they're spraying on each other?
You know the spires
take his shirt off.
Of the trophy? The trophy itself is pretty ugly. But
it
the flagpoles or whatever the other come up, it kind of embraces that notion. The bottles are beautiful. So I ordered a case of that, and they ordered many cases, but they are selling out now. So if you want those as a holiday gift, you should go to Calvert Woodley now.
Can I buy a bottle from your case?
Yes, as a matter of fact, just 10% upcharge. It really is the greatest place. And Michael, in honor of this evening, got us a Sicilian wine. I've got to grab the bottle because I didn't write this one down. He made fun of me for liking labels, but then he picked a bottle with a nice label. It's called Planeta, Planeta. It is a Sicilian wine, and it's am I the only one drinking it? David, you tried it. Hints of what?
Do you have any?
Yeah, exactly. kind of fruity, a little pomegranate, whatever, but they're very proud of this in Sicily, so we like that.
Yes.
And then, where did my label go? The cheese. The guys at La Cheeserie are the best. It's an aged Italian cheese, cow's milk cheese, and they described it as a very serious cheese.
Serious
cheese. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, it's very serious. It can show up anywhere. So there you go.
Okay.
But
this is a serious book.
It's really, because I go there almost every Monday now, and the pace of the place is picking up.
Yeah.
And I had talked about having Michael Sands on next Monday as part of our Turkey Palooza. Can we help Michael with his Thanksgiving dinner show? And he goes, oh, no, busiest night of the year. They're insanely busy next week. Following week, okay. But a bottle is yours. Okay. So, debate of the evening. Blurbs. Back of the book. Richard, we're going to go to you first.
Okay.
Blurbs. Love them. Hate them. Better for the author. Better for the reader.
Well, you know, it's sometimes called log rolling.
Log rolling.
You know, I'll do something for you.
Sure.
You do something for me. And talk about a Latin phrase that's in the news very much this past couple of weeks, quid pro quo.
Yes,
I thought about that.
Boy, I had several people, novelists that I've known for a long time, not highly successful ones, but, you know, sort of like
very few are.
Mediocre ones like me. And I said, could you do a blurb for my book? And they said, sure, if you'll do one for mine.
There you go.
And or write an Amazon review or something like that. In my case, my book touches a lot on The Sopranos, and I was quite thrilled to get one from the actor who played Vito Spadafore.
Vito was a troubled man.
The gay capo. Oh,
yes.
And, so
he
that was
a very
great.
Troubled man.
And then I got one from, the book also touches on Star Trek. I got one from Jonathan Frakes of Star Trek Next Generation, who just happens to be a good friend. We can maybe talk about that a little bit later. He was really the one who gave me the idea for the book. But I think they're important. I think people do pay attention to them. I think it's a great thing to have on the back of the book. I do think, you know, people probably discount them a little bit.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I felt betrayed, actually, by one book I read recently. Fortunately, I don't remember the title because I don't want to say anything defamatory. But it was got a rave review from Lee Child and from Michael Connelly, who are my two favorite
big time
commercial novelists. And I just thought it was awful. Just awful. And I actually got mad at Lee Child and Michael Connelly. So.
I wonder how many people who read the blurbs actually read the book. But I also wonder if blurbs weren't more important in the days when people went into bookstores and touched the book and flipped the book over and look. Jeannie, read them, don't read them, care about them?
Read them, don't care about them, don't trust them. And I'm obviously not a published author, but I thought if I were... I just don't think I could get into that quid pro quo. I would think I would just want to go, don't give them, don't ask for them.
Well, you don't like to ask for favors, but a lot of people would want to do it.
Isn't it, Richard, like to get in
there? Yeah, one of my earlier books, I asked for one from Glenn Close, who is also a friend of mine from years and years ago. Somehow, for some reason, we've drifted apart. Such a pity, too. But my very first book, I asked her, and she wrote me the most charming, lovely note back, and it ended with, I'm sorry, I don't give quotes. So... Yeah, I think some people would want to, you know, particularly television stars, movie stars, that sort of thing, they might want to just draw the line and say no. But when you're a novelist or an author, it's such a big part of the business
I understand, but I just think your life would be a lot easier if you just stepped back and didn't participate.
Michael? You wander into bookstores. Do you flip the book over and look at them?
I do, and I love nothing more than weighing a book in my hand, checking out the paper, because I love the first thing I'm judging is, did they actually spend any money with the production of what this book looks like to someone walking down? And then as soon as you flip it over, I like ranking the blurbs. Who is the highest, sort of the highest value? Q is the best Q brand. And it's interesting because I do read an interesting blend of, I would say, highbrow modern fiction, young adult. I read a lot of young adult, which is very much the quid pro quo. And it's the same 10 authors. And if you can try and latch on to the one buzzworthy author who's about to have a book that launches to a TV show, he or she's going to be right on top. It does hurt though when you see your favorite author give a blurb and you really trust that voice and then it falls flat. But it's so for, the Don Con, I purchased this as an ebook, and so I wasn't I find it fascinating to see what blurbs.
You didn't know until tonight.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know what was on the back. So I knew the cover just from seeing it, but it shifts a lot for me because a lot of the times when I'm reading something that's not necessarily that highbrow top 20 book of the year fiction, to me it seems very similar to the Twitter verse, which is, can I just try and loop in the biggest name on my contact list so that everything that gets pinged around is going to have that name associated with my book going forward?
I think in the old days when books were primarily on shelves in bookstores, and I can't remember the statistic, but it was something like if you could get somebody to pick up the book, physically pick up the book in the bookstore, you had a 75% chance that they would buy it. And I think in that era, those blurbs made a difference. Like, oh, well, you know, I know Julia Child and she likes this cookbook, so I'll get that kind of thing. I think they're less significant now. I remember when I did my book, Lipstick on the Pig, many, many, many years ago, and reasons not worth explaining, I got a blurb from Henry Kissinger, who was pretty hilarious, by the way, because I was asking him to do it. And he goes, oh, yeah, sure. And I said, you must get asked by 1,000 people to do blurbs of books. And he goes, yeah. And they said, interesting. Usually the people that really hate me and say very mean things about me then come to me asking me for blurbs. I'm like, yeah, whatever. But Dominic Canfuso, who's my horrible, horrible editor, couldn't stand Henry Kissinger. And he cut Henry Kissinger's blurb out of the out of the book.
Ooh.
Just decided on his own. David, blurbs, love them, hate them, don't care. You've been asked.
Yeah,
you've written some. For whom have you written?
I wrote one for Grant Hill. He had a book about about artists and their art that he was a collector of. And asked me to write a blurb, and I blurbed for him how smart
did
he was.
Did you read the book?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
How was it?
Good. It was very good. It's very good.
The entire thing?
Yes. There's a lot of wonderful art in there. I've done it once or twice. I'm fascinated by there are I don't know if we get in trouble if I mention the name of the company that seems to always give glowing reviews to every book.
And no.
It just seems odd to me every time I look at blurbs, it's the same company that says, "What a great book."
Yeah.
Yes.
That's their business.
Well, Kirkus is the honest one, actually. I think Publishers Weekly is the kind of the easier one. But my first novel got a review from Kirkus that was not only the worst book review I've ever seen. I mean, the most negative.
Really? Oh, my gosh.
But it was the worst review I'd ever seen of anything, a restaurant or a movie, a play, anything.
God.
The book was... The book, and you know, I had to give the guy some credit, even though I was depressed. It was really well done. The book was kind of roughly based on Dante's Divine Comedy, and the headline for the review was, "Abandon all taste, ye who enter here."
Wow.
So he was good. The only thing I could, you know, console myself with is at least I don't make my living doing book reviews for Kirkus at $50 a shot.
Okay, there you go. See, I did not see this is edifying for me.
Kirkus actually has the reputation, you know, they're in the business of reviewing books, as is Publishers Weekly, as is Booklist, you know.
Yeah.
But Kirkus is the one that has the reputation as being. You know, if they'll call it as they see it.
Okay, well,
that is interesting to me because I've always felt that it was just laudatory regardless. Yeah. So that's very interesting.
The only blurb I actually remember, and I am not saying this because Michael's here, but I remember which one of Tony's books was it where Dave Barry left a review and said, "I don't actually believe this. It's just because I'm a complete liar."
Is it Pumping Irony, the first one? Dax More Cash?
Yeah. I'm not sure which one, but it was so funny.
I also believe that Michael's father, Tony, once wrote a blurb for a friend. He hadn't read the book, and he said, "You know, I haven't read this book, but I'm sure it's great."
It's very good.
And then complained because he didn't get top blurb billing.
We shouldn't name the author of the book, should we?
Why not?
I leave it to your good graces, sir.
I had that experience, too. I asked somebody to do one. He said, "Only if you put me on the cover."
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't realize how catty it was.
Because you got it. You see, this is a publicity opportunity for you, too.
Yeah.
That's why I do them.
To be fair, I think in Dad's case, it was not his. It was his placement relative to one other
particular person. You're right, Michael. Let's not go there.
I know somebody who killed to get somebody to write a blurb, and the deal was had to be on the front of the book, and it was. And literally within minutes, that particular person, the blurb writer, fired, thrown in jail. It was terrible. It was kind of like a Sports Illustrated curse kind of thing. It didn't work. Okay, let's take a break, and then we'll come back with Richard and talk about the Don Con and other things. All right, we're back. It's Chatter on Books. And before I forget, because La Cheeserie took such care in picking out the cheese, it was an aged Pecorino Toscano from Italy. Michael, did you have some? It's really good.
I have.
It's really good. Do you think it's a serious cheese?
Si, va bene.
Yeah, very good. It was really good. The bartender's here. Hi, bartender.
The bartender's
here. Hi, honey. Hi. There's really good cheese here if you want it. I say it all the time, but if you want, it's so easy to go to stores or anywhere in the DMV. And you walk in, Michael, you were in, was it Home Depot recently? Or where were you trying to get the printer?
Oh, I was at Office Depot.
Office Depot.
Yeah, where I knew their stock better than they did.
A, you can't find anybody who can help you. B, you can't find anybody who can help you who knows anything. But you go to Calvert Woodley, they know everything. They know the wine, they know the cheese, they know how to put the two of them together. They're going to save Michael's Thanksgiving dinner. But now we're going to talk to Richard Armstrong about his book, The Don Con, which I really loved. And as Ms. McManus and I often do, I immediately started casting the movie.
Yes, for sure.
But let's talk a little about you. You're one of the few who actually kind of grew up quasi wanting to be a writer. You were a copywriter.
Well, I was NYU. A copywriter. It's a pretty big difference between a copywriter and a fiction writer. We both write, but I really had no interest in fiction at all until a friend of mine, by the name of Bob Bly, is very prominent in the copywriting business. He knew that I was interested in gambling, and he sent me a little clipping from Scientific American that about something called Pirondo's paradox, which was a mathematical theory, part of the game theory, part mm-hmm. of mathematics, that said that you could take two losing games and combine gambling games and combine them in such a way that they yielded a winning result. This was a real mathematical mm-hmm. theory. And I looked at that and I thought, oh my, isn't that interesting? And my first thought was, well, I'll take this to the casino and I'll make $1 million.
Uh-huh. How old were you when you were this dumb?
This was just a few years ago. Oh, okay. This was maybe 10 years ago. And but unfortunately, according to Dr. Pirondo himself, this cannot be used in a casino. You have to have a certain kind of gambling game in order to make it work. And so I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll write a booklet about how to beat craps by using Pirondo's paradox. And I almost did that, and then I thought, well, you know, if I know for a fact that it doesn't work in a casino, maybe it's not the world's best idea to
might
sell a booklet,
be.
You know, might get in trouble with the Federal Trade Commission. And so I decided to write a novel about somebody with less scruples than I who did do that. And that book was called God Doesn't Shoot Craps. And prior to that, I had had no interest in writing. I'd never written a short story or a poem or anything like that. But when the story came into my head and I saw how it was going to work, I just sat down and wrote it in one, you know, I mean, probably took me 2 or 3 weeks to write it.
Oh.
And that was my first.
There are a lot of people listening who hate you for that, by the way, that it took you 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, you know, the downside of that is that I, in both cases, I've written 2 nonfiction and 2 fiction, and they're very spread apart, about 10 years apart. And the reason is not because it takes a long time to write them. It just takes a long time to come up with a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And not only a good idea, I mean, we all come up with ideas all the time, but an idea that will really support a book. That's the hard part.
Yeah, that hasn't been done 1,000 times over, right?
Oh, yes. Well, there's that too. Although, there's a theory out there that there are only 20 plots or something like that, and I do believe in that. I believe in the so-called hero's journey narrative.
Michael's ears are perking up. Teacher's ears are perking up.
So yeah, I think I'm not all that concerned about being wildly original. You want to be somewhat original.
Okay, but I haven't seen too many books, I've not heard about too many books about kind of a washed-up actor kind of coming into contact with some low-level mafia types and then deciding he's going to try to con them. If I captured the essence of it?
That's absolutely
That's about it, right?
Mm-hmm. And I, as I mentioned earlier, I got this idea from an old friend of mine, Jonathan Frakes, who was the second in command of the second version of a Star Trek.
David's our Star Trek
Commander
guy.
Riker.
My wife.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in fact, John is married to Jeannie Francis. Is that a name that means anything
yes.
to you?
Yes. An actress, right?
For a while, Jeannie Francis was just about the most famous woman in the
Laura
world.
Laura and Luke.
She was the Laura of Luke and Laura.
My
right.
gosh, that
whole
goes
country
back.
Was wound up about whether Luke was going to marry
my
Laura.
Right. General coming home from the school in the 80s.
So the two of them have a vacation home in Belfast, Maine. And my wife and I were in Camden, Maine, which is kind of our favorite place to hang out. One time I knew that Jeannie had a little gift shop up there, kind of like a home furnishing shop. And I said to Sharon, why don't we go over there and see, maybe Jeannie will be there. Well, we did. She wasn't there. Neither was Jonathan. But on the way out, I said, let me take a picture of you in front of the store and I'll send it to John. I did do that. And a couple of minutes later, I got an email back from him saying, I'm going to be in Maine tomorrow. Let's have dinner. So we did have dinner, and it was the first time that we'd seen him in, quite a while, and I'd kind of lost touch with what he was doing. And I knew he wasn't acting much because I wasn't seeing him on television, you know. But so I was gently inquiring what he was, how he was making a living these days. And it turns out he does a lot of directing of television shows. Still to this day, he does a lot of directing. But he said, you know, one of the ways that I make money is that I sign autographs at Star Trek conventions. Hmm. And I had never heard of such a thing.
How could you not know that these things are famous?
Now, this was maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
Still.
They've become a bigger phenomenon, but I didn't know. And he said the first time he went to one, he didn't know about it. He was still on the show at the time.
Sure.
And his agent said, you ought to do this. And he was thinking, you know, look, I'm the star of a TV show. Why would I like to do this? Why would I want to do this? And the agent said, well, do you like money?
Cash.
So, exactly. So he went, and he was just astounded by the amount of cash that he was making.
And it's cash.
It's yes, all. It's all cash.
In the book, Don Kahn.
Mm-hmm. And he said, well, here's the thing. You want his autograph, you pay $35 cash. If you don't have anything for him to sign, you pay maybe another $15 for a photograph. And this is not just Jonathan, it's all the others.
Right. You know? Michael's in the merch business on the side. He understands this.
Oh, okay. Then you want a selfie
two
with
for
him.
One.
That's maybe another $25. Mm-hmm. So everybody going through the line is paying something on the order of $75. And the line is going out through the door. And when he came home from that first one, he said, I wasn't prepared. I had money stuffed down my pockets and in my shoes and everywhere. And I was just thinking about that a couple of weeks later, and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if somebody tried to steal all that money? And that was the basic idea behind the Don Kahn.
And that's a really novel idea, having been to those things. And if you've not been to one of these fan fests, you have to go, because it's a part of America that people like us never see. And they dress up in the costumes, and they stand in line for hours, and they're completely addicted, focused on the whole shtick. It's definitely worth doing. But when I read the idea in the story, I thought, why did it never occur to me before? There's a ton of cash there. You know, Willie Sutton, that's where go where the banks are, because that's where the money is. Yeah. It's great.
I wonder, is it the same as getting in line to have an athlete sign, Pete Rose sign a bat for you?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
But it almost seems a little more fervent even than...
Yes, because the people lined up to get Pete Rose's autograph, are wearing baseball jerseys.
I did a story a million years ago about Denny McLain when he got out of jail having a... because he couldn't make any money otherwise, having a card signing. And you would not believe the people that showed up at this thing.
But they were wearing their own clothes.
Yes.
Or they were wearing a baseball jersey. No, these people at Star Trek or some of the Comic-Con, some of those things, they show up in the full-blown outfits, right? If it's a Star Wars one.
Yes, there's the famous Shatner sketch on Saturday Night Live where he says, get a life, you get people.
So I have to tell you a little story about Shatner now that you've brought him up. I think it was this weekend, as a matter of fact, last year, I realized the book was coming out in the spring, and I knew that I would be doing, you know, podcasts, radio interviews, or, you know, other kinds of
you
publicity.
Dreamed about doing Shattering Books.
About it. I knew I'd be doing some.
Someday.
Maybe not as something someday. As good as this one, but I knew that I'd be doing some. And I thought, what if people asked me about a fan convention, and I had never been to one? Everything I did from writing the book was just research. So I said, I got to go to one. And I decided to go to kind of a medium-sized one in Louisville, Kentucky.
Very medium-sized.
Louisville. Yeah. SuperCon, it was called. Mm-hmm. And on the day I was ready to go to Louisville, just before I left for the airport, I went on the internet to look at their schedule to see what I would be doing that day, what panel discussions there were and everything. And boom, there's Jonathan's face, my friend's face. I didn't even know he was going to be a part of it. It turned out he was a last-minute substitution for Brent Spiner, who's another one of his cast members. And so I sent him a text. I said, you're going to be in Louisville tonight? He said, yeah, let's have dinner. He said, or he called me right back, and he said, let's have dinner. And then he said, well, I'm coming in really late. Maybe we should have dinner tomorrow night. So he called me in the morning from the hotel, and he said, it turns out that I have to have dinner with some of the other celebrities tomorrow night. And you're welcome to join us, but I want to warn you, Shatner is going to be there.
Oh.
And Shatner is kind of standoffish with people that he doesn't know. And I went, He said, well, you know, maybe it would be more fun if you and I just went off together. And I said, well, Jonathan, you know, I really kind of would like to meet him, you know, and the other celebrities. So he said, no problem. I'll save a seat for you. So I got to the restaurant that night and I was the last one to arrive. I walked
Bad
in there.
Move.
It
Bad
looked,
move.
No, it was a good move. I walked in there and it looked like Madame Tussauds wax museum.
Oh.
Jonathan was, we were seated at the head of the table, me and Jonathan. Across from me was Shatner. Next to Shatner was Henry Winkler, the Fonz. Mm. Later, LeVar Burton joined us.
Wow.
And it was just a fabulous evening.
My whole childhood is sitting at this table.
Yeah. I mean, these are iconic television stars. Yeah. And, of course, they're all talking show business and everything, so I wasn't saying too much. I was kind of concentrating on my food and listening to it. And I remember I was eating some carpaccio, the Italian appetizer, and all of a sudden a fork came over and took a huge chunk of it and stole it from me. And I kind of looked up like, what the hell do you think? And then I realized it's Captain Kirk.
And Kirk gets the carpaccio.
This man has saved the galaxy a dozen times. I can't tell him to stay away from my carpaccio. I said, Bill, just feel free to have as much as you want. So it was an incredible evening, and I learned a lot about fan conventions. I've been to 3 or 4 since then, and it is a fascinating cultural experience.
So if Jonathan got $75 for an autographed photo, what does Shatner get?
A lot more.
How much more?
Well, yeah, Shatner and Jonathan probably, they have photo, in addition to what I just described to you, they have private photography sessions with people. Mm-hmm. So nice. If I just want a picture of me with Shatner taken by a professional photographer, that's something along the lines of, I would imagine, $500 or something like that. And again, line going out the door.
Right, 1,000 of those a day.
None of these guys are really hurting for money. So they're doing it for reason. You know,
Easy money.
Shatner's probably, he's always got some kind of little fiddle going on the side in terms of work. But Henry Winkler's working as an actor right now,
he's
doing rather
Barry,
successfully.
Isn't Barry? Yeah. Yeah. I love him in Barry.
So they're making some money at these things. They gotta be.
But there's almost never enough. When I first when I first went to work for the cable TV industry, and the cable TV industry in the 90s, early 2000s, all you do is go to conferences, conventions, because we were trying to make ourselves feel better about ourselves because everybody hated us. But you'd go and somebody, you'd go to a conference in New Orleans and somebody would say, A&E would say, oh, we're having a party tonight at such and such a hotel. Come on. Elton John is performing. You're like, okay. Elton John is performing for 100 people. And I think to myself, don't you have something better to do? I have something better to do than this. And was it really worth the $500,000? But I guess it is.
Well, you know, nowadays, a lot of these, rock and roll and country music stars are adding this to their concerts. My wife is in love with Vince Gill.
Who isn't?
I have a neighbor who's 40 years old that I'm in love with, and she says, well, that's a completely different thing.
Safe.
But we've seen Vince Gill all over the country, and we went to see him in Baltimore the other night, and he gave a terrific performance, but I noticed afterwards there's a little meet and greet, and if you pay X dollars, you get to shake hands.
Usually really painful. Really painful.
For him it is, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And completely sterile,
I'm
and it's
sure he
awful.
Just wants to go home and
didn't
go to
we,
sleep.
I'm looking at the bartender. Didn't we once pay for an extra meet and greet for one of our children and her cousins for the One Direction?
We also paid for Gina Davis.
Gina Davis.
That's right, who was not overly nice.
No, she wasn't.
Not overly nice. It was a whole girls, chicks thing, and so the bartender and the daughter went off, and she was, and you would think Gina Davis promoting women and girls would be really nice. Yeah, no, they're often not. Very tall.
But more about 1D?
What's that?
More about One Direction?
So I think it was the kind of thing where, yes, you pay $10 zillion for the tickets, and then if you pay $10 zillion times six, they get the meet and greet
and it's
on stage.
And it is disappointing.
And it's horribly
disappointing.
Yeah, it's not even a cattle call. They just race them by and then it was awful. But it was good because it broke the crush on One Direction. So that was good. Yeah.
Now, I do have to say that I asked Jonathan, I said, what's it like when you meet these people? And he said, you know, it's actually a very, it can be a very moving experience because they will come up to him and say, you know, it was because of Star Trek that I decided to become an engineer or that I went into science or that I went into space, you know.
NASA or became a serial murderer.
Or a serial murderer.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So at any rate, my book anticipates the first gangster themed convention, which in fact is happening
again,
this week.
We're talking
about that collision of that kind of convention and then the mob is so ingenious. When I saw that that's what you were doing, I thought, oh my God, why hasn't somebody else thought of this? And now they're pursuing it.
So it's the Don Con. It's Richard Armstrong. It's just, it's fabulous. So why hasn't there been a Gangsters Con?
Well,
and is this a side business you should be starting now?
I know. I thought
we'll come,
about it.
We'll take
thought
a show there.
It's sort of like the gambling story. I thought about that. I thought, yeah, why don't I do the first gangster convention? And then I thought, well, gee, that might involve a lot of work. And I'm not really into work.
You know what I mean?
So I thought, I'll write a story about somebody.
You truly are a child of D.C. Nobody in D.C. does anything. We just talk about people who do things.
This weekend, Sharon and I are going to the Meadowlands. Where else?
Oh,
you know,
dear.
We're going to be right above where Jimmy Hoffa is.
Sure.
And it's the first Sopranos convention.
They have not had
and
one before.
And virtually everyone's going to be there who's not dead.
How could they not have had one of those before?
It's the very first.
It's unbelievable.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, my God. I would totally go to that.
Are just Sopranos? Are they going to kind of cross-pollinate with Goodfellas?
No, just Sopranos.
Okay.
Just Sopranos.
Oh, my God. I would
And we're just selling books there. I'm not an invited guest or anything, so I'm not. Nobody's paying me any money. I'm paying them to be there. But how could I miss this?
So what's so great about hearing your stories is the same voice enters all the characters and scenes in the book, and I think that's what I find so enjoyable about Joey. Just the sort of affected actor, you know, always trying to name drop and not look like you're name dropping. Even hearing you tonight, you have such a facility.
I've name dropped a couple of times.
These are the fabric of the stories. When you are talking about the Sopranos and Star Trek, and you're always very careful to say, well, you might have seen me in this scene, but I'm not going to say I'm that actor. I'm not going to not say I'm that actor. So it seems like you have a very strong background in pop culture. In these shows, I'm sort of thinking about the literature side. For me, that's a little bit harder to be so fluid with. Do you have a really strong Shakespeare background? Do you have a really good just classical literature background?
Clearly a Shakespeare background.
Yeah.
It's all over the book.
I try to retire every now and then. I'm 67 years, and I just retired again today, as a matter of fact, and this will be my third or fourth. And in 2014, you always need something to do when you retire because, I mean, that very first day you think, oh, my God, what the hell am I going to do today? So in 2014 when I retired, I thought, I am going to read all of Shakespeare. And it's 37 or 38 plays, depending on which scholar you pay attention to. But it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. It really was. It was just such a deeply satisfying thing to do. And then since then, my wife and I have tried to see as many of them as possible. And we've seen probably at least half. And then if you include video and film, I've seen probably three quarters of them. So it's become a big part of my life, and it managed to find its way into here. if I have a background that informs this book, it's not a pop culture background. It's the fact that when I was young, I wanted to be an actor. And so I have I went to New York to be an actor, achieved very little success. I couldn't get arrested as an actor. I couldn't catch a cold as an actor. All those wonderful
cliches.
Things we say. I did certainly have a lot of experience with lugging my 8x10 photo around to casting directors and going to auditions and things like that. So I, in that way, I understand the way Joey Volpe thinks. And yes, it is true. Name dropping is a big part of being an actor. You know, if you have a tiny little part in a movie that George Clooney, starred in. You say, well, you know, I was in that film with Clooney. And,
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
They all do that.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Back in Gwyneth Paltrow with Quinny. Back in Summerstock.
Yes.
I just love how each line makes you go deeper and deeper for the reference. And it's impossible to read it and not just think a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. So I think everyone should have a good back pocket of Shakespeare.
Well, you know, when you talk about pop culture, I want to preface this by saying I'll tell you something that's really shocking. My mother really loves this book.
Excellent.
I mean, you might be shocked to hear that.
That is high
tribute. She loves this book. And there was a long time, it took a long time to get it published. And during that time, she would try to buck me up, you know, keep it out there, keep it out there. And she'd say, you know, I love that book. It's just so much fun. It's just fun. It's so entertaining.
You should have had her write a blurb.
Well, I should have. And she'd always say, she'd say, it's funny. It's just, it doesn't have a shred of depth or substance to it whatsoever. It's just fun. And I'd go, Mom, I do think it has a little bit of substance to it. And she'd say, really? What? And I'd say, well, when it gets published and you invite me to your book club, I will talk a little bit about the substance. And here's what I think is the substance of it. The last line of it comes from Shakespeare. All that glitters is not gold.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if you look through the book, you'll see that the word glitter is used dozens and dozens of times. So much so that for the longest time, I had titled it Glitter. You know, look at my computer.
Somebody had makeup. Somebody had eyeshadow that had glitter.
Yeah, that's part of it. Glitter on costumes, just glitter all over. And whenever the word glitter is used, it's used to talk about something that is attractive but not real. You know, something that's designed to call attention to itself. And to me, that's what the book is about. I mean, it's a comedy, but it's really a satire of American pop culture. And to me, it asks questions like, why do we pursue celebrity so fervently in this country? Why do we put so much stock in becoming famous? Why do people go to these fan conventions and dress up to be somebody else?
Isn't it because they think their lives are better?
I suppose it is. Mm-hmm. But when you stop and think about it, when these fan conventions, if somebody is dressing up, they are actually dressing up to look like an actor who is dressing up to look like something else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's 2 degrees separate from reality. And I just find that fascinating. My mother says it's just fun.
But, did your mom ever invite you to her?
I think it's got a little bit of substance.
Did mom ever invite you to her book club?
She did. She
Excellent.
Did. And she also got me into a men's book club that I did earlier this week. And I've got to tell you, it was like doing a PhD dissertation defense there.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Oh.
They were rough.
Yeah.
They were rough. They sat me down in the middle. It was like a U-shaped table, and they sat me down in the middle of it. And I said, how do you want to proceed? And they said, we'll go all the way around the table, and everybody will say something.
12 angry men.
that's exactly what it was. They started with the guy that I had spent the lunchtime with. And so we'd had a lovely conversation. And he said, he started off, he was the first one. He said, well, I liked the author, but I didn't like the book. And I went, oh, this is how we're going to start.
That's the start.
And, you know, so I've had all different kinds of publicity experiences in my short career.
On a happier note, I mean, as I'm reading it, and Tori, I'm sure it's the same. We're casting it.
We do it.
Have you had, it seems like a natural, have you had interest?
No, my first novel was optioned by, it was optioned by the producers of Xanadu on Broadway.
That's fascinating. Of course.
Yeah. And actually, Dennis Farina, the actor, was interested in Farina. Yeah, we actually took lunch, as we say in Hollywood.
And he's in the book. He gets a wine stain or something on his coat. Yeah.
But this one, not so far. And yes, I think it's very cinematic. And the thing that I like about it from a production standpoint that I think producer would like is that you could have 100 stars in it and not pay anything because none of them have worked for the last 25 years.
You could just cast your net and pull in all of those wonderful Italian mob characters
exactly
from Sopranos.
Everybody who appeared in Sopranos is looking for their next job.
Not to mention all the Star Trek people and whatnot.
Yeah, that too.
And then cast the principal roles with the unknowns and pay them scale.
Right.
You know? And then the others come in, and then you could say, appearing in this movie, William Shatner, George Takei. You know, on and on and on. I think it's a natural.
George Takei has a zillion followers on Twitter.
Yes. Yeah, he does.
I don't know if he's on the piece on he, and anything that is going on in the political world is on top of it.
Yeah.
Have you met him?
No, I have not. He's going to be at Louisville this weekend.
Oh, it's Takei.
I think it's Takei.
In fact, he has like an ongoing feud with Shatner.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things is that Shatner always mispronounces his name. And at this point, I think Shatner is doing it intentionally.
Absolutely.
Is there a next book?
Well, you know, that's the thing. It's those ideas that are hard to come from. I have an idea for a book about Washington.
Never been done.
It's never been done. The rough idea is a book about a preacher who kind of he runs a church that's not doing that well, but a very powerful lobbyist is a member of the church, and the lobbyist realizes that he can funnel money through the church to various candidates.
Here we go. Scam.
And I have a
probably great, so this would be nonfiction.
I have a great title. I have a great title for it. It's Paul's Letter to the Washingtonians.
Nice.
So
nice.
That's as far as I've gotten so far.
I like that one a lot. Okay, well, this one I really love. Ms. McManus, you and I just immediately start casting. Yeah. And I was like, this would be great. It's the Don Con. It's Richard Armstrong.
Ray Liotta is a little past his prime.
Yeah.
But there's a place for him.
Yeah.
Totally a place for him.
Well, he could play the gangster.
Yes, he could.
Yeah. Yeah, for Joey, it's really a part for a middle-aged actor. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you relate most to him, to Joey?
Oh, yeah. I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. Yeah.
Well, we loved him. So thank you for doing this. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back with Deserted Island. You can play if you want. Okay, we're back. It's Chatter on Books. It's the Deserted Island segment, which trying to keep up with Ms. McManus's obsession with the bestseller list. I was looking at it and I thought, well, okay, if you like this book on the bestseller list, you'd like this one better because those of us in the DMV always have a better idea, right? So I thought, pick a book from the bestseller list and say, if you like this book on this list, I've got one that's better for you. So I will start, and then we can go around the table. Richard, I didn't give you the homework assignment. You're welcome to play if you want.
I'll try.
Okay. So I was looking. I've read Elton John's autobiography.
You can't do Elton John. That's the book I'm doing.
Okay. You can do it first then.
Okay.
Okay. You go first then. Okay. What's yours?
Elton John was number 4 this week on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. I just saw him in Philadelphia a week ago. First time
still
ever.
Still reveling about that.
Uh-huh. It was so fantastic.
Yeah.
He's 72 years old. I don't know how long he's got or how long I've
seems
got for that
very
matter.
Young. So,
and it was fantastic. I had never seen him perform before, and it was great. It was everything you thought it would be.
He's a great entertainer.
He's a great entertainer. I have not read the book yet, but from what I've read about the reviews of the book, it sounds very similar to a book I read 2 years ago, which was a wonderful autobiography by Andre Agassi called Open, which is all about Andre Agassi's career. And two things came out of this book. One, he hated tennis. He hated everything about tennis. He hated playing tennis. He didn't like anything about tennis. He just did it because his father told him to do it.
Father was horrible.
His father told him to do it, so he did it. And it's all about that and his kind of inability to cope with not being in love with the sport. And he just kind of did it because he was very good at it. And it was a series of fits and starts. And he was good for a while and he was terrible and he was good again and he was terrible and he was good. And it's just, it's one of the best written books I've ever read, which led me to believe that someone ghost wrote it for him because it's too good. And I saw that Elton John, it was also an ass told to, so I suspect that whoever he wrote it with wrote the book for him. But it's a great and honest and frank book about his drug abuse, everything that he did. He copped to all of it.
Yeah.
And at the end, he fell in love with a very beautiful woman who just happened to be the greatest women's tennis player on earth. So
just
it's a very cool book.
Okay. I'll see you on the Andre Agassi, but I'll raise you one. Raise the Andre Agassi book. Great. Because it was so honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Elton John. I don't think his was as honest. I think it was, he wrote it the way political people write their memoirs, very defensively.
Yeah.
How I want to be perceived. Andre Agassi, it was just let it all hang out there. So if you liked Me by Elton John or the Andre Agassi book, Keith Richards' autobiography, Life.
For sure.
just stunning. It was just the essence of, no, this is my life and you're not going to like it. And some of these stories are horrifying. And you come away thinking he truly believes that all the drugs actually kept him healthy. He's still performing at age 78 or whatever he is. But in the name of honesty and transparency, I thought his was just
and
remarkable.
You can hear his voice.
Yes.
In that
yeah.
book.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's Elton John's voice right. in his book. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Michael? Oh, wait. Richard has a question. A pen. Sure.
A pen to write with? Michael has a pen.
There we go.
I can only hold an idea in my head for 3 seconds.
You write that idea, Michael.
So I misread your email a few
Easy
days
to
ago.
Do. I don't write very well.
No, so I am I'm using a list from Entertainment Weekly because I want to try and bring.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
it's the
I want to try
list.
And widen the list here. Yeah. So I'm looking at something about these brilliant, spooky YA
list.
Tales that arrived just in time for Halloween. And
oh good. Jeannie's giving me the finger.
Oh, no, I'm just moving. I'm scratching my eyes.
Looking down at my choice, which is fine.
It's not
about one specific book on this list. This includes some authors that I've mentioned in the past, including V.E. Schwab, who did The Shadows of Magic, A Gathering of Shadows, which was a series that was well received. So I'm using these YA authors because the book that I'm going to mention, I think, will be out as a TV series or movie in the next year or two. The book is The Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo. She is an author who got her start in YA. That's probably where she's most well known. This is her first foray into adult fiction, though I still think it feels very YA in tone. She is a Yalie. And she brings us back to this Yale world where magic is superimposed over New Haven. All the sort of issues with New Haven are due to it being basically hotspots. And all the dining clubs or finals clubs, senior societies are based around...
A.K.A. fraternities.
Okay, fraternities are based around their relationship to the occult. So we have the Bones.
Nice, Skull and Bones, those crazy people.
They're all the business guys who are doing these... prognostications about the markets, and other people are trying to do contract law via whatever magic they have left. And there's actually one house that is supposed to be the overseer to protect themselves from themselves. It becomes a little tricky because they bring in this outsider. It becomes a little bit town and gown again. They bring in Alex Stern, who's from the wrong side of the tracks, so who's a troubled background from Los Angeles or California. I'm not sure if it's LA, Southern California, but she has issues, and I think they feel like they can control her. And I'm mentioning it with this YA list because I actually think it fits very well with younger readers to try and see what they think about what does it mean to be given access but not to be given full access. Mm. How are you able to recognize that for yourself? And it also goes around to the drugs, the magic that is associated with this world, and talks a little bit about responsibility and sort of how you can protect yourself against some of these charms that are out against you. It includes the lacrosse bro Abercrombie model who has magical potions to get, you know, girls in his bed and the, you know, the revenge actions that come after that. So it's I thought the book itself was flawed, particularly in the last 50 pages, but there's enough good there that I think it'll continue going into the TV series.
Right. We got to get a YA author on. Got to, you know, and there are some good up and coming ones in the DMV. We've got to get one on. We have not yet. Okay. Ms. McManus?
So I kind of worked this backward because I didn't want it like say that somebody on the bestseller list didn't deserve to be there. That
Other than Donald Trump Jr.?
That was an easy target.
We should do something
target.
On that, on the whole idea of how you get on the bestseller list.
Okay, just commercial break. And I back away from Ms. McManus because she likes, Richard, just so you know, she loves bestseller lists. I hate them. Donald Trump Jr., and that has nothing to do with the person to whom he's related by whatever, bulk purchases. The RNC bulk purchases. There are lots and lots of people who get their books on the bestseller list by convincing someone to do the bulk purchases. Mm-hmm. And that's why I am so averse to the list on so many occasions.
Well, and that might possibly be true for Hillary and Chelsea Clinton's
Correct.
Book as well. So we should, yeah.
Everybody does it, right?
Yeah. Fairness, yeah.
Not everybody. No, no.
I should say,
yeah, not everybody does
but
it.
But the ones that right. do it are obvious about doing
yes.
it. Correct.
Okay.
I think the New York Times list has some protections against that.
Not many.
No.
Not many. No.
Okay.
Well, so anyway, so there is a book on the bestseller list that I have read and really liked, and so I sort of want to say, read this, not some other stuff
instead
that's
of
been
you
on
want
previous bits bestseller list. And the book that I want everyone to read is Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow, which is just a gripping, well-reported, well-written book. I mean, if you're looking for a nonfiction book that's well-written, I mean, artistically written, this is it.
Yeah.
And they are hard to find. So I would say that if you were a fan of Woman in the Window or Gone Girl or The Woman in Cabin 10,
so many
people have read about all these women who are sort of like vulnerable and victims and whatever, read Catch and Kill, nonfiction by Ronan Farrow, about women who were vulnerable, who were taken advantage of, and who finally have their day in the light.
Yeah.
So that one, Wonderful, Incredible, She Said.
Wonderful, incredible.
Gives you, if you're not interested in the topic, which most people are, the amount of work these journalists did. So if anybody has doubts or fears or concerns about journalism, which a lot of people should, you read that and you go, oh my God, here are people who really were dedicated to their craft. That is nowheresville in terms of lists. And I can't understand that.
Another book that's not on the bestseller list that is very interesting. It's a different genre. It's not reported like that. It's Know My Name by Chanel Miller, the young woman who was raped by the Stanford swimmer who was given all sorts of,
But that is why, with all my contempt for bestseller lists, then when something like, I've talked about this before, Where the Crawdads Sing, and you see it on that list, and it stays there, and it stays there, and then you're like, okay, finally, all right, you know, I've got a long train ride. And you read it and go, that's a remarkable book. And that did not have a machine behind it. That didn't have a political party behind it, bulk purchasing. It's there because it deserves to be there. Richard, do you get the game?
I do, and I'm going to attempt to win this game by breaking the rules, which is what Captain Kirk did with the Kuriatsi Matsu conundrum, you know.
That's right.
I'm
Kobayashi.
I'm not really a Star Trek fan, but I am aware of that. There was this impossible test at the Academy, and he won by breaking the rules. I'm going to talk about just three books that are on the list.
Okay.
Not only are they on the list, but they've been there forever,
uh-huh.
and I think they're terrific. One is Educated by Daryl Westover.
Yes.
Fabulous book.
Okay, we don't have another half hour. But
the other is Sapiens. Do you know that one?
You know, I really liked you till about 0.05 seconds ago.
Oh, you and your husband disagree about that?
That book is like, what were we just talking about? Testaments or whatever. No, that book is dreadful. And that's one of those books. It is dreadful. And it's like another book the bartender loved, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Blah, 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 blah. It's one of those books where you love, and it's this time of year, you're at a bunch of parties, and you love to, what are you reading? And you tell, because then you sound smart. And you sound elite. And you're like, that Sapiens book is dreadful. Go ahead.
You're wrong.
Dreadful. What's your third one?
Well, I recommended it to a friend of mine, and he said, oh, it would make a good freshman seminar book. And I said, you think I read freshman books? Is that what
that's
you're trying
like
to
the
say?
Surveys we used to do
I
in the cable world when we asked people what they were watching on TV, and they would always say PBS. You ask somebody what they're reading, Sapiens.
So you're currently here for two with Tori.
The third one, and this will come as no surprise. I have a little bit of you know how we think we discovered things even though we didn't, but I found out about this book very early on. I just saw some little blurb there, and nowadays you can't walk down the street without kicking over a copy of it, The Hillbilly Elegy. I mean, if you take Educated and Hillbilly Elegy, I think both of them go a long way to describing what this terrible rift is that we see.
Okay.
In our
Until now, I was going to say really nice things about Richard Armstrong and his book, Don Con. And now, Educated should not be on the nonfiction list. I'll just give you that. Hillbilly Elegy, here's what I'll give you. Hillbilly Elegy was a lot like the book, Gene, help me. Wild Shell Strayed, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In which when the person, whether it was the guy in Hillbilly Elegy or Shell Strayed, talked about what she was actually doing on the Pacific Coast Trail, which was remarkable in and of itself. It was good. When he was talking about what he actually experienced living in that part of the world, it was good. When they all of a sudden put on there, I'm really smarter than everybody else, and I'm going to make great philosophical statements about mankind and civilization and everything else, I just hated it because they weren't equipped for it, and they don't write to it. And I know from personal experience of people who work in small independent bookstores who have experienced Tara Westover of Educated, and she's very full of herself.
Oh, really?
And not very nice. So you're wrong. Pretty much wrong. No. As a matter of fact, no. No. Michelle Obama, always welcome.
Yeah.
No. Okay. I like that. This was good because we all took it different directions. Excellent. Okay, thank you so much, Richard, for being
awesome.
With us, for being
Delight
your lovely
be
bride.
Yeah,
thank you
so
for
much
being
fun.
Here. Yeah, everyone should read this book, The Don Con, and everyone should cast it because it's Ocean's 11. It's everything. It's great.
It's the Sting.
Yeah,
a little bit of the Sting.
Had a little bit of the Sting. I was thinking of the music as well as the people that could be in it. The casting would be so easy.
Mm-hmm.
But who would play you? Who would play Joey?
Who would play Joey?
Yeah.
I actually sent the book to Mark Ruffalo because I thought he would be
Ruffalo.
I had to look and see whether he had blue eyes or not.
Doesn't matter.
Somebody pointed out to me, a friend of mine said, yeah, you can use contact lenses. I wish you'd told me that several years ago. I didn't know.
Gosh. Oh, my God. That's great. Well, thank you for joining us. And when it is made into a movie, we get invited. That's the rule.
From your lips to God's ears.
Exactly. All right, we're going to wrap it up here. A little house cleaning. Go to Calvert Woodley, especially now. Michael, you should be over there kind of full time for the next several days.
Well, I need holiday wine. I have a few visitors coming over, and I need to make sure I have the good stuff for us and a bottle for Tony.
How many people will be attending your first You're in Charge Thanksgiving dinner?
Are you including Bootsy and the Hammer?
Yes.
Well, that's up to eight.
Up to eight. That's good. That's a significant number.
Yeah, Bootsy's got a big appetite.
David?
Hedy Lamarr.
There you go.
Hedy Lamarr was the person behind advances in communication technology in the 1940s that led to today's Wi-Fi, GPS, and Bluetooth.
Holy cow.
I would have guessed.
That's the last one. Isn't she one that did the swam and had the little swim cap on?
No, didn't she do some of those?
No.
Esther Williams. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. How about that?
Go, Hedy. So we're out. We're going to come back next week. It is Turkey Palooza. We're going to help Michael with his Thanksgiving dinner. The hounds are being released here. We're going to have Jean Safer on talking to us about her book, which is I Love You, But I Hate Your Politics, which is perfect for the holiday season. And we're going to try to have a celebrity cocktail. Thanks, everybody. We're out. Claude, thank you, everybody.